Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we take a look back at the aftermath of last summer's Las Vegas shooting with California Sunday Magazine's Amanda Fortini. We'll also learn how the technology that underpins cryptocurrency like Bitcoin could one day be used by produce growers and packers to help make the food supply safer. And we talk with local novelist Tanya Nichols about her new book, The Circle Game. We begin, though, with the story about allegations of discrimination. You may have seen that video that went viral earlier this month, where a white lawyer berates employees of a restaurant for speaking Spanish, not English, threatening to call immigration and customs enforcement officials on those individuals. It turns out there have been some similar incidents close to home. Recently, fear surrounding deportations has been more present in immigrant communities across the San Joaquin Valley. Recent ICE raids have people scared of run-ins with law enforcement, but now that fear has spilled over into resources people depend on, like food banks. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports.
Is our refrigerator, our cold box.
We're standing in a fridge that's the size of a two-bedroom apartment at Food Link Tulare County. The ice box is stacked with produce and dairy products that will soon be in the fridges of Tulare families. Nicole Celaya says some families who need food won't get food. She is the development director for the food bank.
We've been noticing a definite marked increase in hostility out at the distributions, whether it's at our pantries where our partners report it back to us, or at our own Nutrition on the Go sites where we've seen some hostility and aggression towards people, and especially towards people who speak languages other than English.
Families have been facing discrimination at food sites because they're speaking Spanish. The majority of people Food Link Tulare County serves are Latinos and farm workers. Celaya says volunteers and people who use their services have made snide comments about people of color.
We've had people call and say, oh, those Mexicans or those people that are speaking, those immigrants speaking Spanish, they're getting everything, and we're not getting anything.
An operations supervisor for Food Link Tulare County has been to many distribution sites around the county. Patty Tovar recently encountered a volunteer who was upset that someone only spoke Spanish. Tovar, also a Spanish speaker, says his comments started to offend her.
He looked very, very upset, and he started mumbling stuff like, you know, this is America, you only speak English here, and just really rude, and didn't understand some of the words he was speaking because he was mumbling a lot of the stuff. And he, from trying to be a volunteer, he walked away very upset because we had somebody that couldn't speak English.
On multiple other occasions at distribution sites, Tovar says people have been offended when she speaks Spanish. She also says she's seen a decrease in people coming to get food since President Donald Trump took office.
All over Tulare County, I've been to many sites, but you would get people in every community that get upset because there's someone speaking another language in front of them.
Although they haven't seen physical aggression, there has been verbal aggression. Celaya says these issues have become more prevalent and obvious within the last year.
I don't know the concrete reason, but I'm guessing that it's the political climate, that people are feeling more able to be open about their discrimination, about their prejudices, about their racism. And I think they're just feeling more emboldened by the political climate.
Celaya says the people who have been discriminated against are too scared to say anything about it.
Here, ICE has a pretty strong presence. And so people are scared. You know, they're scared to go out grocery shopping, to take their kids to school, and most definitely they're afraid to access resources like ours.
Discrimination and fear at food banks isn't unique to Tulare County. Food banks across the state have been battling with similar issues and working on ways to let people know they don't work with immigration authorities. Daniela Ogden is the Director of Communication and Development for the California Association of Food Banks. She says since Trump was elected, reports of discrimination have increased.
Almost everyone has sent out letters into their community, up to the amount of signage they've had that promotes the fact that a food bank is a safe space for people to access services.
Ogden says larger food banks have even launched marketing campaigns. Food banks want people to know they still can access food regardless of where they were born, the language they speak, and without fear of being deported. She says the fear and the uptick in discrimination against immigrant groups has had a significant impact on their access to food.
It's had a tremendous impact. We've seen entire communities go into hiding. Groups that have, as you mentioned, been historically really hard to reach and to encourage to access services. And it takes a long time to build connections with these communities. And we are seeing them choose to go hungry rather than risk deportation or risk discrimination.
Amber Crawwell is an assistant professor of sociology at California State University, Fresno. She says ideologies that drive discrimination are historically rooted and can have devastating long-term effects on a community. The fear immigrant populations have of being deported goes hand in hand with the discrimination they encounter. Crawwell says if people are seeking out food and are instead discriminated against, then food insecurity won't get better.
Because it's a very vulnerable situation to go out and seek help because you don't have enough food to eat. That's a hard thing to do. And then to be in that situation and somebody is hostile towards you, that can severely damage trust because, you know, you're in a vulnerable situation. You're told that these people are here to help and then they're hostile towards you over something that should not be a basis for being hostile, like speaking another language.
However, not everyone has fought hostility at food distribution sites. Rebecca Rodriguez lives in Fresno and goes to the Mary Ella Brown Center every Thursday to get food. She speaks Spanish and often goes with a group of women, some who only know Spanish, and she has never felt unwelcome.
Majority of the people that come here are Spanish speakers, and there are a few of Asians that come here and they speak their own language.
Rodriguez says she feels comfortable speaking Spanish at the different distribution sites she visits around Fresno.
That's one thing we have to learn, to respect each other's language. I'm happy that I speak Spanish. I'm very glad that I could understand Spanish speakers. And as far as the conversation, there's no discrimination at all.
Back at Food Link Tulare County, Celia says she's purchased signs and posters that explain they don't share information with other agencies. She will give a presentation to all the pantry partners in Tulare about being a sensitive location, places people go for resources like food. Celia says it's important for all locations to be safe and welcoming. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The tragic events of October 1st, 2017 in Las Vegas have faded from the headlines and Twitter timelines in recent months. But the story of the worst mass shooting in modern American history that left 58 people dead, including five with ties to Kern County, didn't end with the death of murderer Stephen Paddock. In fact, when the sun rose on the morning of October 2nd in Las Vegas, it was just the beginning of another story. Journalist Amanda Fortini writes in a new piece for the California Sunday Magazine. She's a visiting journalism professor at UNLV, and she joins us now. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Las Vegas, of course, is a city created on the tourism industry, and critical to that is to managing an image. How did the city respond from a marketing perspective? You start out your piece examining this concept that emerged very quickly called Vegas Strong. Tell me how the city responded in that regard right after the shooting.
Right. So, you know, within minutes of the shooting, the crisis management team for the Las Vegas Convention Authority, the LVCVA, was, they had put the word out to their crisis management team and to their entire, kind of marketing team. R&R Partners is their advertising group that works for them. And they were already meeting, within 20 minutes or so. By 11 o'clock that night, they had all convened to meet. And actually, Vegas Strong was something that they didn't invent, but that was, you know, spontaneously cropping up on social media. And they decided, okay, this is a slogan that we're going to go with. They, you know, by 1 a.m. that night, they had talking points. By dawn, they had put out a memo to all their tourism partners. They responded incredibly quickly. And by, you know, I think Wednesday, I say it in the piece, they had a television spot ready. So, the response was truly immediate. It was within minutes of the shooting, and as the chaos was still going on, you know, as people were still going to hospitals, I say in the piece, the sort of PR doctors were doing their job.
Now, certainly people bought into that campaign on social media. As you mentioned, it originated there. But there were also critics of the Vegas Strong hashtag and movement out there, among them your students. Tell me about that.
Right. So, you know, I've interviewed so many people for this story, and the response to the Vegas Strong hashtag was really twofold. Many survivors that I interviewed, I should say, found it comforting, found it meaningful. A lot of people I interviewed had tattooed Vegas Strong on their bodies or were wearing bracelets that would say Vegas Strong. But I did hear from many, many people, including my students. I met with, I was teaching a seminar, you know, a couple of days after the shooting, and my students were in there. I think it was actually, I canceled my classes for the days after the shooting, but the week after we were sitting in seminar, and they were saying, you know, we just feel that we weren't allowed to grieve, that it was so quick, the pivot to strength. And they were saying, what about Vegas, you know, angry, or Vegas sad, or Vegas depressed? And over the coming months, I would hear that from, you know, a pretty vocal contingent of people who felt like it was a little bit quick, a little bit glib, and that it didn't sort of allow for the full range of emotions that people feel after such a tragedy happens.
There have been many cases where Las Vegas has been criticized for cheap commercialism. Is this one of them?
I don't know that I would call this cheap commercialism. I mean, I really think that, you know, if they were making cars, they would have to go back to making cars. It's their industry, you know, tourism. And so I actually think that the response was pretty tasteful. I mean, maybe it was a little quick. There was merchandise made the next day. I can see, I do see the criticism. I sort of can empathize with the people who criticize that, yes, it was a little fast, but I don't know that I would call it crass or cheap, really.
Again, we're talking with journalist Amanda Fortini, who has a new piece in the California Sunday magazine about the aftermath of the Las Vegas shooting and looking at it from a lot of different perspectives. One that I had not thought of and is really interesting is this issue of makeshift memorials that popped up and mm-hmm. how the city dealt with those. Tell me about how that began and how the city responded.
Well, so we've seen these makeshift, I mean, across the country, you know, we're seeing these makeshift memorials whenever a tragedy like this occurs. I actually reported on Aurora in 2012, and they're the same kind of thing where people go to either the site of the crime or somewhere nearby and leave teddy bears and candles and cards and handwritten posters and, you know, all kinds of kind of memorabilia or ephemera. And we saw a massive response like this here in Vegas at the Welcome to Las Vegas sign. And a man from Illinois also brought, you know, 58 crosses, and those were placed there. So around each victim's cross, there were sort of individually specific, you know, memorabilia or, you know, sort of little tchotchkes and things. And then around the Welcome to Las Vegas sign, there was, like I say in the piece, a snowdrift of things. And then, but what happens is that, you know, these seem like sort of, you know, like I said, ephemera, but they actually have a great amount of meaning. Like, these are, you know, totems of mourning for people. So it's not just sort of like a dime store teddy bear or just, you know, a Hallmark card. People are leaving these from their heart, and they're intended for individual victims, and they mean something to the families, and they mean something to the people who leave them. So then the question becomes, what do we do with them? Because they do have such significant sentimental value. And they also, if you want to think about it historically or anthropologically, at some point they might have, you know, historical value when someone wants to look back and say, how did people grieve in 2018, you know, when we were having, unfortunately, a rash of mass shootings in America. And so museums are tasked with, you know, how do we archive these things? How do we save these things? What do we do? And actually, a curator Pamela Schwartz, who is in Orlando and has worked on the Pulse nightclub memorial, she has sort of taken it upon herself to write a manual and to call all of the, whenever there is a mass shooting, because unfortunately we're having so many, she calls the curator of the local museum and says, look, this is what you're going to be tasked with. This is what you're going to face. You need to think about how you want to deal with it. What do you want to save? What do you want to, you know, archive? What do you want to get rid of? You know, because she said sometimes museums, they're small and communities are small and they don't have the resources to sort of save and archive everything like they're doing in Las Vegas. So they might choose to save a few things that are symbolic of everything that was left. It's really interesting, actually. It's a sort of modern problem that we haven't really seen before.
You also write about another modern problem, or at least maybe a solution to one, and that's this class that has been springing up and has now been received well throughout the community. It's called Stop the Bleed. Tell me about how it was first received in Las Vegas and now the aftermath after the shooting.
So it's a national campaign, and one of the trauma surgeons here at University Medical Center, Dr. Douglas Frazier, he had heard about it at a national conference and brought it back to Vegas. And before the shooting, he said he tried to get, you know, various casinos and hotels and nightclubs interested in it, and they didn't really get many takers. But after the shooting, you know, he told me that they've gotten quite a few, and they've trained people at MGM, at Hakkasan Nightclub, many different other, you know, major establishments here in the city, schools, nursing homes, churches. They've trained like 4,500 people. And what the class does, I should say, so that the listeners know, is that it teaches people to civilians, you know, who, without medical training, to tie tourniquets and how to pack wounds, so that if you are faced with someone with a gunshot wound or a major laceration, you know, like from people had from climbing fences and things, you know how to staunch the bleeding or stop the bleed, which is what the campaign is called, until help gets there. And so I call it a kind of, in the piece, a grim pragmatism in the face of, you know, lack of tighter gun control. Like, we're not going to get tighter gun laws, okay, so we're going to teach civilians to know what to do in another situation like this. And I went and got trained myself. I actually took the class.
You've seen this play out over the last few months in Las Vegas, of course, such an industry town. How has the overall entertainment, tourism, gambling industry fared since October?
I think, you know, I haven't looked at the most recent statistics, but when I was looking at the sort of quarterly in January, and I think they should, I don't know if they have new numbers out yet, actually, but when I looked at the year end, they did have a slight downturn, which they attribute, you know, the convention authority of the industry attributes not only to the shooting, but to, you know, fewer rooms being available or whatever. But I do think that the shooting had an impact on, the numbers show it, on tourism here. But when you go down to the strip, you don't really feel that. It doesn't feel like things have changed. It did feel there was a different air to things in the first week. But after that, it felt like, you know, it always feels. And I've spent a lot of time on the strip.
Before we go, there's so much about the shooting that remains unknown, specifically the motive behind gunman Stephen Paddock. You write that Las Vegas is a hotbed for conspiracy theories overall. What is the mood like in the city right now, just with the unresolved nature of this story?
What is the mood like? Well, I think that people are starting to feel, I feel like the balloon is has been punctured a little bit in terms of the conspiracy theories, because in the last month, the Metro, LVMPD, the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, has started to finally, after being ordered by a Nevada Supreme Court to release documents and evidence. You know, we've had witness reports, we've had officer reports, we've had a little bit of footage from two of the first officers to breach the room. So I think people are finally feeling like we're getting some information. But, you know, there's a lot that feels unresolved to people, I think, especially because there's no motive, especially because we have not yet seen the footage of the first person to breach the room. You know, there's just a lot that remains unknown, and, you know, hopefully in the coming weeks and months we'll get more information. And I think especially the survivors that I've spoken to, that provides a degree of closure for them to have some of this information.
You mentioned that you covered Aurora. We often hear about these tragic mass shootings and how it forever changes a community. Is Las Vegas forever changed by this? And if so, how?
You know, I think that the sort of, interesting. I think the jury's still out on that, you know. I do think it forever changed. I guess I would say it does forever change a community, because something like this, a trauma like this, a tragedy like this, it affects the individuals in the community. You know, I mean, people are healing, but it takes time, and it really does reverberate throughout the community in many ways. It's just what I tried to show in the piece, a kind of prismatic look at all the different ways that people who were there and weren't there are affected, and try to help and, you know, try to look toward the future about how to memorialize this. How it will change Las Vegas has sort of yet to be seen. I don't know quite how to quantify it, I guess. But I'm here watching, and I'll write more once I know.
You can read Amanda Fortini's piece, What Happened in Vegas, the days, weeks, and months after the worst mass shooting in modern American history, in the new edition of the California Sunday Magazine, online at californiasunday.com. Amanda Fortini is a visiting journalism professor at UNLV, and she joined us today on Valley Edition. Amanda, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
After it was first reported in March, the recent E. coli outbreak in romaine lettuce appears to be drawing to a close. But that's only after it sickened 172 people in 32 states and resulted in one death in California. One reason it took so long to get under control is that produce can be hard to trace through the sometimes dozens of suppliers, distributors, and wholesalers in the produce supply chain. FM89's Carrie Klein has this story on why food tracebacks are so difficult and what's being done to change that.
Grow and Farming is one of the country's largest suppliers of stone fruit. Its sprawling Sanger warehouse, full of clunking sorting machines and clickety-clacking conveyor belts, produces millions of pounds each year of peaches, nectarines, and plums. Vice President of Technical Operations George Niklich claims the company can trace every nectarine packaged today from field to bin, and so can Garawan's customers, thanks to a special label slapped onto bins by a pneumatic arm.
What is that, about a 2x4-inch label or thereabouts? Has a barcode with a very long number underneath it.
By scanning this label, his customers can trace these nectarines back not just to Garawan, but to the packing lines and even the fields they came from.
It's an important piece of the communication between us and our customers.
But traceability like this is not the produce industry standard. Niklich explains each company typically handles its own record keeping. Some may even still use paper. Because Garawan's fruit is grown and packaged in-house, tracing its nectarines is relatively simple. But Niklich says that information can get lost further down the supply chain.
You've got hundreds of thousands, millions of individual products, and you're often tracing them, you know, from the orchard to the consumer, and there's no standardized system to accomplish that.
This 2x4-inch label is a first step toward a standardized system. It's the keystone of the Produce Traceability Initiative, or PTI. It's voluntary, but it's estimated that more than half of the companies in the U.S. produce supply chain take part. It's difficult to tell if it's improving our food safety, but it does serve as the backbone for a newer, higher-tech initiative. And the advantages are clear for suppliers like Garawan and their customers.
We've got our dialect, and they have theirs, and you need a translator. PTI-compliant labels are trying to serve as a translator between producers and their customers.
The Produce Traceability Initiative was born around 10 years ago after a 2006 outbreak of E. coli in spinach. Ed Tracy, a supply chain expert and one of the industry leaders of the PTI, says that outbreak killed 3 people and sickened almost 200.
And the industry got together and said, what we have in place is not good enough. We need to be better.
He says in the case of an outbreak, tracebacks may have to be done in baby steps, finding the grocery store where the problem food was sold, looking up purchase orders, and fanning out to contact the many suppliers that could have shipped it. Tracy says so much could change if each case had a unique identifier, like a standard barcode known as a G10.
It gets much more narrow if they can go back through their records and can identify, okay, on this date, we shipped 5 cases of spinach, and here was the lot number and G10 that was on that case.
Deputy Commissioner Steven Ostroff with the FDA agrees there's room for improvement in our food supply. In this most recent E. coli outbreak, it's not yet clear how many companies were using PTI labels. But Ostroff believes if they all had, the investigation would have improved.
I'd like to think that it would have made the tracebacks that we were engaged in not only considerably easier, but considerably faster.
As industry adoption of the PTI has grown, it's difficult to tell if investigations have gotten any faster. Speed is not tracked as comprehensively as illnesses and deaths. But data from the CDC do show that over time, more and more outbreaks are getting traced back to their source, rather than remaining a mystery. Still, tracing food could get better and faster. IBM is building upon the PTI to create a food safety system based on blockchain, the technology used as a ledger for tracking Bitcoin transactions. Using blockchain, every step in the supply chain would be recorded and stored in one centralized location in the cloud. Bridget McDermott of IBM says you can imagine what that could mean for food tracebacks.
If you could go from it taking a week or weeks to identify the source of the problem to taking seconds, that this has a real impact on people's lives.
So what's keeping these from becoming widely adopted? IBM's blockchain initiative is limited for now to a few major distributors. The Produce Traceability Initiative is available to anyone, but it costs money. Companies are more likely to adopt it if they have pressure from consumers. Still, regardless of how we trace food back, there's one factor that will always limit how quickly investigations can happen: our ability to remember what we ate. It's tricky, especially when it comes to processed foods, but it's a lot easier with fresh nectarines. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The recent images from Hawaii of the eruption of the Kilauea volcano have been captivating. But closer to home, a much larger eruption once took place, not that far from Fresno. It created the Long Valley Caldera near present-day Mammoth 765,000 years ago, just 76 miles from Fresno as the crow flies. It forever changed the landscape of the Eastern Sierra, creating a valley 20 miles long and 10 miles wide. While no eruptions are anticipated in the area anytime soon, Mammoth is still a hotbed for geologic activity. To get a better idea of what happened there and how it compares with what's going on today in Hawaii, we spoke with University of Wisconsin geologic science professor Brad Singer, who is the co-author of a new paper about the eruption. He joins us on the phone. Brad, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
765,000 years ago, that sounds like a long time ago for any of us on Earth today. But put that in perspective in terms of geologic time. Is that relatively recent when we're talking about things like massive eruptions?
Yeah, this is a very recent part of Earth's history. The Earth, based on several lines of evidence, is over 4.5 billion years old. So this is exceptionally recent. It occurred in the middle of the Pleistocene epoch. And so it's young enough that we can see all the evidence of the eruption. We have the caldera still intact, and we have the huge deposits called the Bishop Tuff, which the volcano produced.
So give us an idea of the scope of this eruption that took place 765,000 years ago. This long valley that's 20 miles long, 10 miles wide, was that created during this eruption?
Exactly. The caldera today sits where the roof of a magma reservoir was brewing for probably tens to hundreds of thousands of years in the Earth's crust, in the shallow upper reaches of the Earth's crust. And eventually that magma reservoir became destabilized. And that's a lot of what the research we were doing with my student Nathan Anderson and I and my colleague Wes Hildreth of the U.S. Geological Survey is to try to understand better what these processes are that lead up to eruptions that destabilize these large reservoirs of magma. So the caldera now is where the roof of the magma reservoir was prior to the eruption. And when the eruption took place, magma vented to the surface through a number of conduits and fractures that now define the oval-shaped ring of Long Valley caldera. And that eruption produced what's called the Bishop Tuff. Tuff means pyroclastic rock. The tuff is comprised of ash shards, which are sand grain-sized particles of glass and crystals. But also there are lapilli and blocks of pumice, frothed-up magma full of vesicles, full of bubbles where volatiles were in the magma trying to escape from it. And that was a very explosive eruption because the magma there had quite a large quantity of water dissolved in it. And when you take the lid off, just like opening a can of soda and decompress it, the volatiles, in the case of a can of soda, it's carbon dioxide, is dissolved in the liquid at high pressure when they bottle it. The water is dissolved in the rhyolite that formed the Bishop Tuff. But when you take the pressure off and release it and vent the magma to the surface, the water can't stay dissolved in the melt, and it dissolves. It becomes a separate phase as bubbles, and that's what makes the eruption so explosive. We're talking orders of magnitude more explosive than the eruption that's going on in Hawaii today.
And when we see those amazing pictures that are coming out of Hawaii and the red-hot lava that is oozing from Kilauea, is that what one would have seen had we had the technology and video back then to capture this, or was this a different type of eruption?
The eruption that formed Long Valley Caldera and created the Bishop Tuff was a different kind of process and different kind of phenomenon altogether. We're pretty familiar with Hawaii. It's been on the news this week, and this eruption is just the end of a long series of eruptions that have taken place over the last nearly 40 years. The Hawaiian eruptions are pretty tame, despite there's danger to the locals there, and there are some small explosions occurring at the summit crater, and you've got lava fire fountaining out of the ground. And fissures, it's still quite tame compared to what went on to form the Long Valley Caldera. The estimates in the literature that I'm familiar with indicate that the Bishop Tuff, the pyroclastic material that was ejected during the eruption, comprises about 650 cubic kilometers. This current eruption in Hawaii is some small fraction of a cubic kilometer of lava coming out of the ground. We're talking something nearly 1,000 cubic kilometers venting to the surface quite rapidly, probably in less than a week at Long Valley, and pouring out over the landscape and raining out as ashfall over the entire western United States. And the eruption at Bishop that formed the Bishop Tuff in the Long Valley Caldera was large enough that the ash plume must have reached, into the stratosphere, and when it collapsed, part of the eruption column rained down into valleys that drained down towards Fresno and the Central Valley in California. There are outcrops that preserve the Bishop Tuff on the western slope of the Sierra Nevada, which is quite remarkable. So the scale of the eruption at Long Valley is orders of magnitude greater than what we're seeing in Hawaii right now. And it would have had pretty widespread impacts locally within, 25 to 50 kilometers of Long Valley. Pretty much everything would have been quite devastated and buried in hot ash, 800 degree to 700 degree centigrade ash deposits. But the airfall took place and deposited ash, as far away as Nebraska. From that eruption. So that's a different scale. It's a continent affecting scale of eruption.
So Mammoth is about a 5.5-6 hour drive from the Fresno area. That's because of the Sierra and the mountainous terrain. There's no direct roads, but it's only 76 miles away as the crow flies. Many of us here in the valley have felt earthquakes that have originated in the Mammoth Lakes area. What's the state of geologic activity in that area today?
I'm not an expert on the local geology there, other than our studies of the magma reservoir processes that led up to the eruption of the tuff. My colleague, who's a co-author of the paper, Wes Hildreth, has done a lifetime's worth of work on the Bishop Tuff. It appears that the system is a waning system. He uses the term moribund to describe it. It's unlikely to be able to produce something like the Bishop Tuff again anytime soon. Magmatic activity has waned tremendously since what led up to the Bishop Tuff forming eruption. There have been lots of subsequent eruptions, Mammoth Mountain being one of them, in the last 100,000 years, but nothing on the scale of the Bishop Tuff. It is an active region tectonically. It's the western edge of what we call the Basin and Range Province. So there are large faults that bound the east side of the Sierra Nevada and faults that are beneath the caldera structure at Long Valley, and these faults are active. So some of the earthquakes you're feeling are due to movement on those faults. It's tectonic. There may be a very minor bit of seismic activity that's due to the movement of fluids in the crust. There's a paper that Wes published late last year that talks about what some of the drivers are for the background seismicity in the caldera, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's due to boiling of fluids, not new magma injecting in there, but groundwater and water that's moving around in the rocks that are above this cooling body of magma that's left over from the Bishop Tuff system. That's heating up and changing to steam or supercritical fluid, and that's triggering some seismic activity. All in all, it seems like a system that's kind of on the wane in terms of magmatic activity, but it's still a very tectonically active area.
Before we go, I just have to ask, watching what's happening in Hawaii, is this something like Christmas morning for geologists across the country and across the globe? Are all of you and your colleagues glued to the TV and the latest scientific reports coming out of Hawaii?
There are many that are in that category, I think, volcano junkies. I have never worked on Hawaii myself on that particular system. It is the most active volcano and the best monitored volcano in the world. So for me, what's interesting is to see how the observatory, the U.S. Geological Survey Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, works to move their operation and adjust to what's happening and improve the way they collect data on the eruption and what triggered it. So I do follow that, those parts of it. But it is, you know, this is the real Earth. It should not have taken anybody by surprise that there's an eruption right where this is happening, because there were historical eruptions during the last 200 years since European people settled in Hawaii. There's a lot of recorded eruptions right in this area along this rift zone, and this is just the most recent one. If I could afford to get on a plane and go there for the weekend, would I go watch the eruption? Sure, I would do it in a second. You know, you don't get these opportunities at this scale very often.
It's a fascinating unfolding story, and another story not too far away from the valley that's fascinating in its own history. Again, we've been talking with Brad Singer, professor of geoscience at the University of Wisconsin. He's an expert on the Long Valley caldera that erupted near Mammoth, what is today known as Mammoth in the Eastern Sierra, 765,000 years ago, an eruption that carved a caldera 20 miles long, 10 miles wide, and just 76 miles away from here in Fresno in the Central Valley. Brad, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A new novel from Fresno-based author Tanya Nichols tells the story of an attorney, her young client, and how they must both deal with tragedies in their lives. Titled The Circle Game, the book is set in the Valley and was published this March. Tanya's work has appeared in the North Carolina Literary Review, the Sycamore Review, In the Grove, and the San Joaquin Review. Nichols teaches creative writing at Fresno State. And for the last 11 years, she also serves as the coordinator of the Young Writers Conference and editor-in-chief of San Joaquin Review, and she joins us now. Tanya, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tanya, this is your second novel. The first one came out a few years ago, The Barber's Wife. How did writing this book compare to the first one?
The Barber's Wife is historical, and it required a lot of research before I could even jump onto the page. So I actually went to Oklahoma, spent some time there, researched medical information and also a lot of information about outlaws in the 30s. Took place in 1931 to 1932. So I studied a lot about Pretty Boy Floyd, one of the characters. This novel was less research-based. It takes place in Fresno and the surrounding area, and goes back from 1968 to 2005, back and forth, alternating by the chapters. So it didn't require as much research.
We often hear authors talk about how the second book sometimes is either a challenge or this, it comes a lot easier than the first. Was either of those the case for you?
This is giving away a secret, but I actually wrote my first draft of The Circle Game first, before I wrote The Barber's Wife, and it was terrible. So I just put it in a drawer, and one day I just thought, I can see where I had that all wrong. And it took me about a year to completely revise it, reconfigure it, but it was the same story, just told in a different way. And then that was actually pretty exciting because it really taught me that sometimes work has to breathe or process before you can, I don't know, make it work. And so I pulled it out and dusted it off and turned it into this version of The Circle Game.
So tell me about Bernie Sheridan. What makes her tick?
Bernie is always on a quest for justice for herself, for every client, for everyone she meets, and she's partly cynical and jaded by her own childhood traumas and always wants to make things right for other people because she feels like she's been done wrong.
And she goes through a process of reconnecting with her biological mother. Every time I hear someone who's actually gone through this process tell the story, it's an incredibly powerful one. Did you draw upon things that you had heard from other people who had gone through that process? Tell me about that, since it's such a something without comparison in so many other ways.
Yes,
in our human experiences.
A friend of mine told me her story one day, and that was the catalyst for the novel. And like Bernie, she had been given up for adoption as a baby, and then her adoptive parents had a tragic death, and so she was given up a second time. And that was Bernie's experience. She was twice released from her parents. So that was where I got the idea. And then this friend of mine also reconnected with her biological mother. Their stories are quite different, but I did call upon this friend to talk to me about what it was like and if she felt any bitterness or resentment to, you know, for the woman who had given her up, and those types of questions. So it was really interesting to discover that process through somebody else that I knew and cared about very much.
We're talking with novelist Tanya Nichols today. Her new book called The Circle Game was just published in March. It's available, and we'll be talking about that in a moment, how people can get the book. How much does the Valley factor into this novel?
Quite a bit. I love Fresno, and I love the Valley. I live here because I want to live here. And I wanted a novel set in Fresno. I feel like we have a lot of poetry. This valley is so rich with writers and just hard and beautiful landscape that I felt like it was really an important part of the story. And I just wanted a novel set in Fresno. So.
What's it like setting that book free? It's kind of like pushing a child off to school for the first time, or at least I can imagine. That's how I would think of it. You said that you wrote this originally some time ago and then completely reworked it. Tell me what that experience is like, actually saying, you know what, this is finally finished. I'm not going to do anything else to it. This is the work as it stands, and then opening it up to the rest of the world and to do with it what they will, including people on the radio.
It's absolutely wonderful and absolutely terrifying at the same time. It's the culmination of years of work, and I think that's the thing that many people, when they read a novel, they don't realize that. It takes a very long time and a lot of hours and work and days, and to actually hold it and see your name on the cover and on, you know, on the spine of that book is so rewarding. I mean, there's just almost not words to say what that feels like, but it also is completely terrifying that your work is out in the world and you want people to like it, to respond to it positively.
The novel is told through the eyes of two different women, and not just in perspectives, but actually in a literary device. Tell me about your decision to approach telling the story in that way.
I wanted to be able to get into the mindset of both the birth mother, Julie Randall, and also the child as an adult, Bernadette Sheridan. So the only way to really get into both of their heads was to separate the story so that it was two different points of view. And it made it fun and interesting to shift the time from 1968 to 2005. So I actually enjoyed doing it that way.
Does that actually make it more interesting or more challenging for you, just as a writer, to deal with making all of that come together?
Yes, and you do have to get the details right. And I can tell you, like, I caught myself all the time saying, well, that they didn't have that in 1968. She didn't have a cell phone. I don't think I use cell phone, but there were things you just have to check historically that they worked in that era. And so I found that to be quite fun. I like the research part of it.
You mentioned that you want to see more books written in Fresno, or about Fresno, novels specifically. When it comes to this place, what is there anything that you specifically wanted to highlight or provide some sort of commentary on? You know, the valley is so rich in its diversity, and its landscape is quite stark and beautiful all at the same time. The people here come from all over the world and have so many different pedigrees and backgrounds. What is sort of the valley to you?
The valley, it is all of those things. And, you know, this just patchwork of lives and stories. And those stories, of course, fuel all the writing that goes on here. But part of that is my own complicated background as a child. My family moved a lot. And between kindergarten and senior year in high school, I changed schools 10 times. But there was this odd thing that we kept coming back to Fresno. Like, I began school here, and then we moved away, and then we came back to Fresno, and then we moved away. So that, in my mind, Fresno became home. This was my home. No matter where we moved, no matter where I lived, I always felt like Fresno was home. And so when I had a chance to come back here, I did. And so I just have a lot of, I don't know, connection with this valley, with the people, sense of place.
Was this something that you always wanted to do, to be a novelist? You got your MFA in 2004 from Fresno State. Had this always been on your radar, or was it something that grew over time?
It grew over time, but the idea of being a writer, I can look back and remember that I had these strange little I don't know, fantasies of being a writer, but I didn't really know that was a possibility in my world. I had no concept that you could be a writer. And it wasn't a real job, and I needed something with a real job. And so I forgot a lot of that until one day when I was cleaning out my mother's home, I found a composition book from when I was 14, and it was from here in Fresno, Hamilton Middle School, and it was full of stories and poems and a note from my teacher saying that she hoped I would publish one day and she thought I might be a Fresno poet. And it meant nothing to me, you know, in 1970. But as an adult, when I saw that, I thought, I guess I was a writer. I forgot that I used to do a lot of this. And then you get busy.
Is that a similar experience to what you hear from your students at Fresno State in creative writing today? That they didn't know at some point that being a writer was even an option?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I love the Young Writers Conference at Fresno State, is we bring high school students to campus for a day of creative writing. I don't think a lot of those students understand the possibilities until they actually experience it. And if we don't have creative writing in the schools, and many schools just don't have it, it's not a real possibility. It's just kind of a fantasy that somebody could write a book. So you have to make it seem real for them. And nobody made it seem real for me until I went to college that you could actually do this.
Let's go ahead now and hear a brief excerpt from the book, if we can. As you mentioned, Fresno plays a significant part in the book. I think we have an excerpt that illustrate some of that for our listeners.
Yes, this is just landscape, you know, Fresno landscape. And just to set it up, Bernie is an attorney and she's leaving the courthouse and walking back to her office. A whisper of clouds stretched across a fading lavender sky, and the light breeze offered a bit of hope from a relentless summer that had stretched into October. Fresno was famous for summers that burned like hell itself, and dreary winters of dense fog that shrouded the valley in a blind mist. This was one of those rare in-between days, the type of day that must have lured those first settlers to stop and begin planting crops and building homes. Courthouse Park was a scattered patchwork of cool shade and deep shadows where gray squirrels darted across the grass and up the mottled branches of the meandering magnolias, Chinese elms, and tall pines. A constant parade of deputies in and around the courthouse made it a safe playground for the kids whose parents fought inside, battling over couches and televisions, weekend visitation and child support. Bernie quickly strolled through the park, ignoring the napping winos stretched out on the grass, past benches filled with bored civil servants, frightened jurors munching on bagels and muffins from the coffee cart that stood in the breezeway, all under a perfect sky.
Fresno-based author Tanya Nichols reading one of the opening passages from her new novel titled The Circle Game. When you published this book earlier this spring, you're still teaching classes. What was the reaction from your students that their professor had a new novel out?
My students are wonderful, and they were very excited for me. And I know I went in one day and I said, keep having this crazy dream that my car is crashing. And they're like, it's because you have a book coming out. So I'm driving very carefully. But they were analyzing my dream for me based on the novel. And I will tell you, it's a wonderful feeling when students walk in carrying your book, asking you to sign it. You know, just they took the time and the money to order a copy and bring it to class to get a signature.
If people want to get a copy, tell us about how they can. I don't know if you have any events coming up, but tell us about how people can get a hold of you and get the book.
Okay. As far as events coming up, I will be reading at the Respite on the River on June 13th. The book, probably this week, will be available at Clovis Book Barn. It's also available on Barnes & Noble online and Amazon. And directly through the press, alternativebookpress.com.
All right. Well, we look forward to the event at the San Joaquin River Parkway, the River Center there, Respite by the River, of which this station is a media sponsor. Again, the book is called The Circle Game. It's a new novel by Fresno-based author Tanya Nichols, who joined us today. Tanya, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe, for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You could subscribe to our podcast and get all of our stories on demand on our website, kvpr.org. You'll also find the link to download our mobile app for iOS and Android platforms. And you can leave your comments there as well, kvpr.org. And be sure to follow us on social media. Just search Valley Public Radio on Facebook and on Twitter. We are at KVPR. For our Valley Edition team, producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, who's out on assignment, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.